This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new Republican-led Congress convened today. High on the Republican agenda is overhauling the welfare system. During Bill Clinton's presidential campaign, he pledged to end welfare as we know it. Last summer, he presented a plan that would provide more job training for welfare recipients and require those who remained on welfare after 2 years to join a work program. But the new Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, says the Clinton plan doesn't go far enough. Gingrich has his own, more restrictive plan, known as the Personal Responsibility Act. My guest, Jason DeParle, covers anti-poverty policy for the New York Times. We asked him to bring us up to date on the welfare debate. Let's start with the provisions of the Personal Responsibility Act.
There's two sets of ideas in the Republican camp about what to do about welfare. One is to put welfare recipients to work, and there are work provisions in there. After 2 years, you have to go into a work program. You could stay in the work program for a few more years, and if you still hadn't found a job at the end of that, you'd be left with neither work nor welfare. So that's the work camp. There's a second camp in the Republican Party, which often is dubbed the illegitimacy camp, and that group of people says the problem isn't putting, the challenge isn't to put welfare recipients to work, it's to keep them from having children outside of marriage in the first place. The way they propose to do that is by denying all benefits to mothers of children who are born out of wedlock under a certain age. Different proposals have different age. I think in the Personal Responsibility Act, it would be anyone under 18 would be ineligible for benefits. At a state option, they could raise that up to 21. And that's for the lifetime of the mother. So if you're a 19-year-old woman, you have a child out of wedlock, it doesn't mean you have to wait until you're 21 to collect welfare benefits. It means that neither you nor that child could collect benefits for the rest of your life. All the talk about orphanages that the public has probably heard has come out of that part of the provision. What do you do about those families, about mothers who have children and are now ineligible for any kind of benefits?
So under the Republican plan, you only get 2 years of welfare for a lifetime?
You get 2 years, right, 2 years of AFDC followed by some eligibility for a work program. It's up to the states how long you could stay in. I think a maximum of 5 years, a minimum of 1 year. So it's possible that after 2 years on AFDC, 1 year in the work program, so it's a lifetime total of 3 years, you could be out on the streets.
And you could never be eligible again?
That's right. Under the Clinton plan, there were a complicated calculus for earn back provisions that if you worked so many months, you could bank so many months of public assistance credit again. I don't believe that's in the Republican plan.
I think the part of the Republican welfare plan that has gotten the most attention has to do with cutting off money for children of teenage mothers and creating more orphanages. Do the architects believe that this will discourage girls from getting pregnant?
Well, that yes, they do. That's the hope that without the abolition of AFDC would bring a marked reduction in the out-of-wedlock birth rate among young women.
Have there been studies that offer any evidence to back that up?
It gets very technical. They've been debating this back and forth for 10 years, looking at, there's a lot of natural variation in the welfare benefits between one state and another. Mississippi pays a mother with two children something in the neighborhood of $150 a month, where California pays somewhere around $630 a month. Those aren't precise figures, but that's the idea. So social scientists have tried to look at the economic incentives and by comparing people in one state to another. I think there's been shown to be some slight difference in the birth rate linked to the amount of the benefit, but curiously only for whites, not for blacks. I'm not sure what the explanation of that is supposed to be. Perhaps there's cultural factors that override the economic factors, but there's slim evidence that changing the benefit level could make some minor difference. I don't think there's any evidence that it would make a huge difference, although intuitively it would suggest that it would. If you simply abolished all AFDC, you would expect there would be some reduction in the birth rate, if nothing else, through an increase in abortions. The question is how much and at what cost. Even if you cut it by half, what happens to the other half of people?
And
And there's no particular evidence that it would fall by as much as it have.
How exactly do orphanages figure into the Republican plan?
I think that's an issue that's been largely misunderstood. There's two debates about orphanages. One is whether for children who have already been taken away from their parents because of abuse and neglect, is some sort of congregate setting like a group home a better solution than the foster care system as it currently exists. That's not really, and that's an issue that people are people of goodwill disagree on all sides, and there's a debate among that, even within the liberal community about whether a congregate setting is better than the foster care system. The issue isn't really orphanages. The issue raised by the Republican plan isn't really orphanages. It's whether the society is willing to create orphans, and that's a crucial distinction, I think. Under the Republican plan, some children would be taken away from their families for no other reason than indigence. It's not that their mothers would neglect them or abuse them. It's that their mothers don't have any money. If they had AFDC, they could afford somehow to keep the family together. Without AFDC, they'd be rendered completely indigent, and the children would have to be taken away under some circumstances. That's the difference.
Would you say the Republican proposal is more about changing behavior or saving money?
Well, that's a good question. I'd say it's more about changing behavior, but it's the product of a compromise between different camps with different agendas. I think the people who've been most involved historically, people like Santorum, Representative Clay Shaw, I'd probably even say Gingrich, care more, talk more about changing behavior. But I think there's a lot of other people who see it as an opportunity simply to save money. I don't think it'll prove to be that. I think that one of the least understood things about the AFDC system is about the cheapest solution. I mean, at least in the short term, unless you buy the idea that you're going to have radical changes in behavior as a result and everyone's going to become middle class simply by dint of their improved character, it's much cheaper to send a mother a welfare check and have her stay at home than it is either to put her to work or to house her children in some alternative setting.
You did a recent New York Times Magazine cover story on a woman who's going to extremes in order to stay off welfare. Her name is Marianne Moore. She lives in the Cabrini Green Housing Project in Chicago. She works at a kitchen for the Salvation Army. Tell us what her morning schedule is like in order for her to get to work and to get her kids off to school.
Well, she grew up in Cabrini Green. She's not living there now. And in fact, that's part of the problem because Cabrini Green's in the center of downtown Chicago. Marianne lives in a subsidized apartment in the South Shore of Chicago, about 10 miles south of the city core, south of Cabrini. She has to get up at 3:30 in the morning to get to work by 6. She has 4 kids. She has a 14-year-old, a 5-year-old, and 2-year-old twins. So she's up at 3:30. She leaves the house at 5, takes the kids to Cabrini Green, drops them off with her mother there at about 5:30, and then drives another half hour north to get to the shelter by 6. The kids then have to have a pretty difficult day. They get to the grandmother's house at 5:30 and wait till about 7:30 when the 14-year-old takes the 5-year-old to his Head Start program. The two of them get on a city bus together, and then Marcello, the 14-year-old, goes on the 8th grade, comes back at the end of his day, picks up his little brother at Head Start, and goes back to Cabrini Green to wait for his mother. The 2-year-old twins stay at the housing project with Marianne's mother or her sister, and Marianne goes on and spends the day at a Salvation Army shelter where she cooks meals for about 100 people.
You did the math, taking her salary, then deducting the expenses, you know, what it costs her just to go to work. Do you remember what the figures were and how that compares to what she'd be making from welfare?
Well, Marianne actually makes more money than most people who come off AFD could expect to make. She was making $8 an hour, plus she's getting a lot of overtime. On the weekends, she works 2 days in a row, 13-hour shifts, so she's at the shelter at 6 in the morning and doesn't leave until 7 at night, and she's getting time and a half, so those are $12 an hour time that she puts in. Even with all that, however, she's little, if any, better off than she would be on AFDC. she has about spends about her income with all that would be about $1,645 after taxes. But there's a lot she has to subtract out of that. Her transportation is about $400 a month. Her child care is about $100 a month. She has to pay a student loan payment. Her rent went up. When you net it all out, it comes to about $775 a month. We figured out how much she would make if she simply was on AFDC and food stamps, and she'd be about $200 a month better off. I think it's important to remember, though, when people hear figures like that, they often think the solution is to cut AFDC. But AFDC has been cut substantially in the past two decades. Its value, inflation, when adjusted for inflation, has eroded by about 40%. There's a fascinating study by a Rutgers sociologist named Catherine Eden who tried to figure out how a mother with two children can live on benefits that average $380 a month, and she found basically that they can't. Virtually every AFDC mother she studied had some sort of unreported income, either through a part-time job that she hadn't reported or through a boyfriend or a relative. You simply can't live on what welfare provides. But frequently you can't live on what work provides either. You're caught between two unpalatable options there.
My guest is Jason DeParle. He covers anti-poverty policy for the New York Times. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're discussing the current welfare debate with Jason DeParle. He covers anti-poverty policy for the New York Times. Last month, his profile of Marianne Moore was on the cover of the Times magazine. She's struggling to keep her job and stay off welfare. Now, you said that Marianne Moore held about 11 jobs in 5 years. Why so many jobs? And is that at all typical of people who have been on welfare and are trying to get back to work?
It's very typical. About 70% of the women who come on to welfare for the first time will leave within 2 years. But the problem is that two-thirds of them or so will eventually return. They find that they simply can't find a palatable alternative to AFDC. It's kind of you can't live with it and you can't live without it. The problem is that most of the jobs that these women can qualify for pay little. Often don't provide health insurance, so a lot of time Marianne at times has quit in order to get her children medical care, because if she goes back on AFDC, she qualifies for Medicaid. That's been a big problem for many, many people. In fact, the original Clinton plan was predicated on the notion that you had to do health care first. That's one of the reasons why they pushed for health care before they pushed for welfare reform, because without universal coverage, many of these women will become worse off by leaving AFDC to take a job. And there's a variety of other factors. Child care, what do you do with the kids? And her own, those are the sort of structural problems that liberals would often point to. They say that wages aren't high enough, there isn't enough child care, there isn't enough health care. A host of other factors come into play, the ones that conservatives are more likely to point to. A lot of these women don't have the social skills that you need to maintain a job. They have problems getting there on time. They get into fights with coworkers or their supervisors. These jobs are not very appealing. One of Marianne's jobs was guarding a parking lot in the Chicago winter. They're often boring, difficult, harsh, repetitive, and they get discouraged.
How do you think a conservative and a liberal would offer different interpretations of the meaning of Marianne Moore's story and the lesson we should take away from her story to understand the larger welfare system?
One of the things that was striking to me about Marianne is she could serve as a Rorschach test or a mirror for, you could read into her experience almost any lesson you wanted to. She certainly fits the liberal diagnosis that the problem isn't welfare, but the problem is poverty, meaning that she doesn't have the education. There's no place for her in the economy. She can't earn enough to support her family. She's left without health care when she goes to work. She doesn't have reliable transportation. She doesn't have reliable child care. They would say that the solution to Marianne's problem would be to provide better job training, to provide more child care, to provide universal health care, to expand wage supplementation programs like tax credits, that the problem is in the economics of it. You need to bolster her earnings capacity and make it easier for her to go to work. I think a lot of that's true. The conservative diagnosis there would be that her problems exist with her own motivation and her own behavioral patterns. And she herself often points the finger at herself. I mean, I think there's a lot of that is true as well. She had children out of wedlock beginning at age 19. She developed a drug problem, which caused her to lose a number of jobs. She was a cocaine addict for a while. She went into rehabilitation, has been clean for a couple of years. She herself sometimes says that she gets discouraged and she's quit jobs simply because she lacked the motivation to stick with them. You could read into her experience of being in and out of 11 jobs over 5 years to support basically whatever set of theories you come to the situation with. I think it's both sets of diagnoses are true. What was most striking to me about her life is that it didn't get any better when she went to work. She didn't grow up on AFDC, but she did grow up in poverty. Her mother lived in the Cabrini-Green Housing Project. She was surrounded by extreme violence growing up. She was 8 years old when the first time she saw someone killed. Her son was 7 years old the first time he saw someone killed. And when she went to work, whether she was working or she wasn't working, she was still living in a very poor, very violent neighborhood, and she saw little economic gain. The math always came out to about the same. I came away from that thinking that the real problem in her life all along had been poverty and violence rather than the rules of the welfare system.
What are her concerns about changes in the welfare system, even though she's not on welfare now and I'm sure hopes not to be on it again?
I think her main concern is whether there'll be something for her to fall back on when these interruptions come up. She got sick right after. I stayed with her for a couple of weeks in late October, early November. She got sick right as I was leaving and ended up missing 7 days of work. The twins got a stomach flu. In fact, I caught it while I was there, and I was out down with it for about a day and back up the next day feeling fine. Marianne, it knocked her out for 7 days. She was just so weak from getting up at 3:30 in the morning constantly and so worn out. She didn't have a sick days for that, so she lost that pay. Her car kept breaking down while I was there. She spent $500 to repair it, and it broke down 10 days later. When you get immersed in her life, you feel how fragile her hold on the employment was, that she couldn't get to work without the car. She couldn't get to work when she was sick. The child care always threatened to break down when her mother was having problems or going out of town or any number of things constantly threatened to come up and keep her from getting to work. And her fear is that if that happens, that her concern is that there'd be some safety net to catch the family. She's been homeless before, and I think homelessness is a real tangible prospect for her, that if she loses a job and she can't go back to AFDC, that's where she would end up.
Jason DeParle is my guest, and he covers anti-poverty policy for the New York Times. You know, two of the really big issues on the agenda are welfare and crime. What kind of connections do liberals and conservatives make between welfare and crime, or poverty and crime?
I'm glad you asked that, because we've been talking about behavior, and that's certainly the way the Republicans want to define the welfare issue, that the welfare issue is one of character, it's one of behavior. An alternative hypothesis is that the welfare issue is really one of poverty. I think the public assumes that welfare is, when they talk about welfare, they use it as a proxy for a lot of other things they don't like in society, like educational failure, crime, out-of-wedlock birth, poverty, violence, all the things that Americans are naturally and understandably concerned about in society. That gets bundled up and it's called welfare. And the tacit assumption is that if you cut welfare, those other problems are going to go away. It's quite possible those other problems will only get worse, things like crime, violence, and poverty. It really depends how you define the problem. Is welfare the problem, or is welfare... I came away from my time with Marianne Moore thinking that the real problems in her life had been poverty and violence, and that welfare had not particularly helped her and not particularly hurt her. It was a sort of neutral factor on the sidelines.
How soon do the congressional hearings on welfare begin?
Next week, right away.
And what do you think the chances are of the Republican bill passing?
In its current, by the Republican bill, if you mean the Gingrich proposal, in its current form, I would say it has a good chance of passing the House. I would expect it to be modified substantially when it gets to the Senate. But no one knows for sure. I mean, one of the interesting things about the welfare debate is how fast and far it's changed in the past couple of years. When Clinton was first talking about his own proposal to impose a two-year time limit and then enroll people in community service, the conventional wisdom was that he would never go forward with something like that. It would be riddled with loopholes. It would sound tough, but in reality, never quite live up to it. In fact, he did live up to it. He produced something even tougher than he had pledged, and it's been dismissed as far too tepid and mild. So anyone laying bets over the past few years on how far and how strict and how stringent the welfare debate would come, you couldn't be wrong by overestimating how far and fast it would go to the right.
Why do you think that's happened?
It's happened for two sets of reasons. One, the welfare system doesn't work, and there's lots of legitimate cause for concern. The out-of-wedlock birth rate is at record highs. The welfare rolls are at record highs. The system doesn't work, and anyone looking at problems to fix in America would want to start with that toward the top of the list. But it's also happened for less appealing or less noble reasons. I think when people... The unspoken agenda often, not always, often is a racial one. I think when people think about welfare, they often think of minorities, particularly blacks. And politicians have found it expedient and to their advantage to use welfare, and it evokes a lot of unspoken agendas as well, I think.
Well, Jason DePaul, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jason DePaul covers anti-poverty policy for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.